Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with politician and comedian Tom Anio about his Mincing Words, his solo show about his magical mystery tour into the world of California politics. It's at the Marsh. You'll also hear about San Francisco Opera's opening production of Andrea Chenier from one of the singers in the production, Janae Bridges. Composer Andrew Lippa is also in studio, who will share details about his show at TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, plus details about a production of The Conference of Birds that's being staged down in San Jose. Stay with us. My first guest is politician and comedian Tom Anio, whose magical mystery venture into the California State Assembly, Mincing Words, begins a run at the Marsh here in San Francisco next week through October 15th. It's a timely show in this election season. Tom will offer a peek into the world of politics from an insider as you join Assemblymember Tom while he navigates the Sacramento political scene in an effort to take the ass out of assembly. Tom is a legendary San Francisco leader who has served the city for four decades as a teacher, school board president, president of the San Francisco Board of Soups, as well as state assembly member. He came out as the first openly gay teacher in San Francisco in 1975 and has since been at the forefront of reform on many issues, including LGBTQ rights, including working with Harvey Milk on the infamous Briggs Initiative, affordable housing, education, labor, immigration, prisons, and marijuana reform. Tom's also been a stand-up comic since 1980. It's a pleasure to welcome the mother of gay comedy to our open airwaves.
Thank you very much. After that introduction, I am exhausted. So thank you very much.
Well, I'm exhausted just reading about this spectacular career of yours. My time in San Francisco dates from when you were on the Board of Supervisors here in San Francisco. And I read that you moved to San Francisco back in 1963, the year I was born.
Really? Well, I certainly also wanted to wish you and the station a very happy birthday. I have a long history with KALW when
Please.
I was on the school board.
And sure.
It was in great danger. It was during the Bush-Reagan years, and people wanted God back in the classroom. I always said, well, if she can find a desk, she's more than welcome. You know? But we did have to put up a fight. You know, it's always been a struggle for the arts in San Francisco. Fortunately, we've come to the rescue, but many times it's been on the precipice, so to speak. And I'm really excited about doing this one-man show, kind of returning to my my roots, so to speak. And,
So thank you again for all your efforts on the LGBTQ, et cetera, front. Take us back to those days of the Briggs Initiative, and for those of another younger generation that frankly can now take a lot of the liberties that you and your colleagues fought so very hard, they can kind of take those for granted now. Were you initially scared to take this on?
Yeah, usually, but I think San Francisco was so nurturing around that time. A lot of politics were happening, very eclectic, you know, the women's movement, the burgeoning gay movement, anti-war, anti-Vietnam, civil rights, and so particularly if you were young, you were juiced, and it seemed to. I heard so many homophobic things on the play yard when I was teaching, and worse within the teachers' room. That was really appalling. I always make a joke about, you know, homophobia. You know, it's the irrational fear of three gays breaking into your house and redecorating it against your will. So I wanted to dispute that. And so we started a group here in San Francisco that Harvey Milk attended. In fact, he even got lucky at that meeting and went home with a very handsome teacher from Contra Costa County. So that was Harvey's blending of politics and
work and pleasure.
A lot of it, yeah. So he was very, very supportive in those days when a lot of people were not. They wanted you to stay in the closet. There were a tremendous amount of closeted gay teachers, who were afraid to come out. And someone said, well, I don't see any gay teachers. I don't know what you're advocating for. And I said, oh, please, you know, show me your room full of teachers. I'll show you a gay bar. You know, I mean, let's just get real.
So this Briggs Initiative, bring us back to that and your discussions with Harvey about it.
Well, it turned up right about the time, and who knew, you know, politically, you never know where one's fortunes are going to break. But it came about the time when he was elected, and it was such an extreme position. We had kind of taken care of it here in San Francisco with a non-discrimination clause. And so I think he recognized the opportunity, and he was quite a champion, because there was in those days, even then, a more conservative kind of gay establishment, so to speak. And they really wanted to leave the word gay, lesbian out of the campaign literature, and they wanted to not show us in the true light, the everyday light, you know. And he did fight that. If you saw the last movie, the Hollywood movie, Sean Penn is very good about dressing down the establishment in those days. And, you know, that was his role of being a maverick.
Well, you had a cameo appearance in that movie, we should mention, right?
Yes, I did. And I'm very grateful for my Academy Award. I want to thank the Academy and, of course,
Sisters,
Sean Penn.
Was it the Academy of Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence that gave you the award?
Yes, I was elevated to sainthood, and I got beatified. I went to a little beauty salon in Daly City and got beatified. So.
Speaking of the Sisters, you also have a long background with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
Yeah, I remember being on the board, and there were people who were interested in disenfranchising them for some reason or other, and became to be a big, big hazaray. And finally, they wanted to deny them their permit because they felt they were irreverent. Yeah, hello, that was the point.
Exactly.
So we were able to push back on that, and one of the more conservative members of the board went after me and attacked me, and I responded, you know, you have to walk a mile in my pumps to see my point of view. Unfortunately, the Sisters survived that that attack.
So from the Assembly, from the Supes up to the Assembly, which is the gist of your one-man show, Mincing Words.
Yes.
Talk to us about Sacramento and your material there.
Well, it was certainly a baptism of fire. It was 104 the day that I got there. And, you know, we're used to the cool, foggy breezes here in Sacramento and San Francisco. So that took an adaptation as well. But I got a nice seersucker suit, and I thought I looked pretty cool. Around the LGBT issue, there was still a lot to accomplish, and particularly the more conservative members of the Democratic Party and the Republicans, and they always made a big deal out of sexual preference, and I felt it was my duty to educate them and say, you know, my sexual orientation is gay, but my sexual preference is Brad Pitt. no doubt they were scandalized. And then, you know, we had... I lived through two governors. The first one was Arnold, who, you know, vetoed gay marriage and did a lot of... What do people want. And he was very nice to me in the beginning. He tried to set me up with a nice Mormon family, of course. You know, and a lot of the environmentalists like Arnold because, you know, he was against offshore drilling. And I don't want to get too risque here, but apparently, you know, if you talk to his nanny and his wife, he did a lot of onshore drilling as well. And then Jerry Brown.
Family radio.
Family radio, KALW, 75 years old. You know, also Jerry Brown's a very interesting guy.
Well, let's back up to Schwarzenegger. There's there's something that we can't mention on the air. There's an infamous, famous acrostic letter from Schwarzenegger's office that opposed Assembly Bill 1176. Take us to that. Does that come into the show at all?
Yes, indeed.
Well, talk to us about that.
Yeah, there's also a large reproduction of the letter that he sent. So he was angry with me for many things, and so he vetoed a bill that was a nothing burger. Even Republicans had voted for this bill. It was to help out
unanimous
support of San Francisco.
Right.
So because of his being angry, he gave me a boilerplate veto. Oh, you know, we don't really need this. It's all that stuff. But if you looked at it closely, there was an acrostic. And so it was the first letter of the first sentence. And if you have a visual of that, it's easier. But the first letter of the first sentence.
Along the left margin now, right?
On the left margin was IFUCKYOU. And that was his veto of my. And he claimed later when it made a bit of a press debacle. He claimed that it was a coincidence.
Oh, yes, a coincidence. Yeah, sure it was.
Stephen Hawking said.
Who first caught it?
My staff. I think they wanted to be quick because I think they were proud of it. But
that all led up to just a very minor altercation, a difference of opinion when he was making a public appearance in San Francisco at a Democratic event, right?
Yes, yes. It was in response to my term of endearment towards him, which you'll learn about in the show.
So we'll hear more about Schwarzenegger as well as Jerry Brown, you mentioned.
Yes.
A different sort of governor.
Yeah. Well, you know, he had been a Jesuit, and there are still residual fingerprints on him about that, so to speak, no pun intended. And, you know, I went to 16 years of Catholic school, and it's made me the man I am today. You know, Jerry practices what I consider to be canoe politics. He paddles to the left, and then he paddles to the right. So his vetoes weren't as florid or obscene, but they were sometimes at odds with how we might think in the Bay Area around domestic workers, immigration, which, of course, as we know, is a big issue right now. But he was also could be very good. And we had a transgender bill that we submitted to him about school kids and their rights. And, you know, this was 2 or 3 years ago that I authored. And he signed that within 2 days. So that's what I mean, a little bit to the left, a little mm-hmm. bit to the right. And, you know, you have to take your seasick medicine, you know, when you're dealing with him. But, you know, hopefully he finds his way, to, you know, in conclusion. He vetoes them, and then if you come back, you know, you have another shot. So.
Give us a little taste of some of the other foibles from Sacramento that will make it into the show.
Well, you know, there's the DUI foible. I don't know what it is. There's some credibility. There's some compulsion for members to get caught doing under a DUI charge. And while it's so silly is because everybody knows where the checkpoints are in Sacramento. There's no surprise. They've been there for 30 years. But we still have this compulsion of members who've imbibed too much to drive by that checkpoint. And then it's a very familiar trope. They get busted. They're sorry. They go to AA. There was a deeply closeted member who went after all kinds of LGBT movements and bills. And he was caught at 2 a.m. hitting a stop sign by the checkpoint with a young man in his passenger seat, and so he came out and came to apologize to all of the LGBT members, and I don't know whether it was my age or whatever, but it just seemed that it was a pro forma thing considering all the damage he did. So I gave him one of the old Queen 1930. Expressions, which was, you know, Mary, get off my dress. it was just too much too soon to forgive. And he continued to vote against LGBT. He continued to vote against LGBT bill. So,
Tom, from running to mayor to being on the soups to being up in the assembly, now with your one-man show returning to a comedic bent, is there a fifth or sixth act coming out of you that we should expect?
Well, we'll have to see how the show goes. I've encouraged Colin Kaepernick to come early in case it's standing room only. I don't mind a thing.
Very nice.
And I did get a text from Anthony Weiner, but it's family radio. So
yeah, true enough. Yeah, well, one Weiner at a time here in San Francisco.
Yes,
thank you. Yes, indeed. Tom Aviano's Mincing Words is at the Marsh Thursdays at 8, Saturdays at 5. It's running through when?
October 25th.
October 25th, information at themarsh.org. Tom, thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. We do have the perfect segue music to my next guest, Andrew Lippa. He's the composer of I Am Harvey Milk, recently semi-staged at Davies Symphony Hall with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus and the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. I'll talk with him next. There's a lot in this tune that applies both to Harvey Milk and to Tom Amiano. Tom, have a great run. Stop in again soon. Here is You Are Here from I Am Harvey Milk.
First gay man, elected to first gay man, elected to I'm that man, elected to gay and Jew, Jew and gay. What will the Pope do? What would my mom say about the first gay man? Elected to represent, expected to change and cope, climb a rope, face that slope, give them hope. I'm the one they've trusted, so I'll just do what I told them I would do. I'll barrel through, but standing here in City Hall, all dripping justice wall to wall, I recall that sticker on the map that says, that screams, that calls out to everyone. Standing when they told you you would fall, you would fail, you would feel the crush. But you're here, you are here, and the old you can't believe it's coming true. But it's you, and without a doubt, you are here. Palace walls where we had once been barred. Here within these hallowed halls we enter proud and scarred. Some may threaten, some misquote, some may need to clear their throat, but we won the final vote. So cheer, this is our year.
You are here.
Walking when they told you you should crawl. You should cry. You should be ashamed.
You should be ashamed.
But you're here.
But you're here.
You are here.
You
have triumphed through the fire and the cold. So behold, you are always this and only now. And you are how, you are when, and you are then, and you are here.
You are here. Words and music by my next guest, Tony-nominated composer, lyricist, performer, as you just heard, and producer Andrew Lippa. That's from I Am Harvey Milk, originally commissioned by the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus in 2013 and revived just last season in a Davies Symphony Hall performance by the chorus with members of the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. In another interesting coincidence, Bars has a concert this Saturday evening. More on that later this hour, and a ticket giveaway just perhaps if you stay listening. And Andrew Lippa, gosh, a happy coincidence to have you following Tom Amiano here on the show today.
Fantastic.
Just
thanks
amazing.
For having me.
Well, last summer, TheaterWorks Silicon Valley included Andrew's The Man in the Ceiling based on Jules Pfeiffer's graphic novel as part of their New Works Festival. His most notable works include The Wild Party, which received the Drama Desk and Outer Critics Circle Awards, The Addams Family, which received a Tony nomination for Best Original Score, and Big Fish, which was nominated for the Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Music. He makes his home in the hotbed of musical creativity, New York City, I believe.
Yep.
And has been Kristen Chenoweth's music director for many years. You're here on the Left Coast once again at TheaterWorks Silicon Valley in Mountain View for The Life of the Party, a review of some of Andrew's great tunes performed with friends. Welcome once again.
Thank you, David.
So give us a little bit of insight into the creation of an original musical score. Is it more a labor of love or more like making sausage?
I can spend a long time talking about making sausage, but I'll talk about musicals. But first, let me also, like Tom did, say happy birthday to KALW. And I realized on the way over here, your call letters are Andrew Lloyd Webber. So this is the perfect place for me to be. He's a knight, by the way. So it's Knight Andrew Lloyd Webber. So that's how I'm going to remember you from now on. Thank you, Sir Andrew.
That's great.
And his birthday's in March, I think. And so the making of a musical, no musical is made the same way twice. Everything that I have done, at least in my career, everything that I have done has been inspired by my desire to make it, and whether I was related in some way to the characters, in some way to the story, understood. Even the Addams Family, which was a big budget, big thing with stars, Nathan Lane, B.B. Newirth, etc., kind of project. I came on board that project for the same reason I come on board anything, which is I loved these characters. I grew up with these characters from the television show, and I knew the original Charles Adam cartoon panels. And so if I love the characters and I want to tell their story, that's a reason enough for me to start working on a musical. It's such a long process, making a musical and getting it to the final. One of the famous quotes I think is attributed to Jerome Robbins, musicals are never finished, they merely open. Mm-hmm. And that's been my experience, actually, working on projects where you open them, they're successful, but you keep working on them the next time you get a chance. And many of my mentors do that. You can see even Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics to Fiddler on the Roof, only recently was tinkering with one of the songs and changed a couple words in one of the songs 50 years later.
Wow,
so
yeah.
That's an inspiration in itself.
Well, I saw that you did some work at the Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut. That's a wonderful hotbed of creativity there.
Yes, I was very lucky. It was my first professional job, was as a pianist in a production of It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, which was a rethink of that show. So funny how times have changed. When that show opened in the 60s, the quote-unquote bad guys were several Chinese characters, the Chinese-Americans, or I think they weren't American. They were just Chinese people who came to America. And in 1992, they wanted to update it, and I had nothing to do with this, but they updated them. They made them Arabic characters, as if to think like that it wasn't cool to make them, to deal with Chinese stereotypes, but it was okay in 1992 to deal with Arabic ones.
Great, of course, times have
changed again. So that was a wild ride of a production and sort of a rethink of that production. And I think they rethought it again because they didn't get it right even in 1992.
So I remember a conversation with Stephen Sondheim on one of probably with Terry Gross and Fresh Air or something about, he was saying, it's not just a matter of writing down what's in your head. It's real, it's craft. It's a lot of work that goes into the creation of what may become a hit song or not.
There's so many components to making a musical successful, and the part that I'm responsible for, or the parts I'm responsible for, primarily the music and the lyrics, there's a great amount of craft and a great amount of sense of craftsmanship, the notion. I love that the organization that represents American theater writers is called the Dramatists Guild, and it is a guild. It is an organization where older members and experienced people help guide younger ones and give them the tools, much like if I was working shoeing horses in the old days, I would learn from a master how to make a broadsword or how to make leather. And learning the craft of making a musical is just as important as anything. The myriad of decisions that go into any particular moment, why a character sings, when a character sings, what a character sings, how a character sings, all of those questions are easily answered incorrectly. And so some of it is guided by gut and your sense of theater and my sense of theatricality, what I want the characters to express at that moment. That's guided by my personality and my emotional life. But you also have to see these things in front of an audience to really step back and assess, is this adding up to something? Because
right.
the long form, the 2.5 hour play that you've written has a cumulative effect, and it's hard to know what that is without looking at it.
Mm. So, and in addition to having some tunes in your head that were are appropriate for all of that to meld together.
Yes, well, you know, it's like you mentioned, Stephen Sondheim, who is one of my great mentors and someone I know and has been so helpful to me throughout my career. Steve taught most of us who born after him that music can be an extension and should be an extension of character. And so it's not only about having a great tune, if that's what you're going for, but also having the kind of music and a world of music that is appropriate to the story and to that character, but that it's also something that can affect the storytelling as a whole and affect your audience members.
Talking with Andrew Lippa, whose one-man show with friends is down at Silicon Valley TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, The Life of the Party. Andrew will be joined shortly. Continuing with Open Air, we'll hear about the André Chenet production of San Francisco Opera, as well as the Conference of Birds, a fascinating dance production that's happening down San Jose way. Andrew, in addition to your own full composer credits, you've written some additional music to You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, music and lyrics by Clark Gesner for the 1999 revival. So how did that come about, and what did you add to that show?
Well, that was a joyful mistake. I got asked in 1998 to be the musical supervisor and arranger for that Broadway-bound production. And as I was discussing working on the show with the director, Michael Mayer, we talked about the notion that the character of Sally, he wanted to include the character of Sally. She was an invention later in the life of the Peanuts comic strip that was, she was actually invented after the original You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown show happened in New York. And so Michael Mayer said, what would be a good song? And he gave me a few strips that were about Sally having a new philosophy in life. And I turned that into a song called My New Philosophy. And Kristen Chenoweth premiered that song, and she made quite a big splash with it and got a lot of attention for it, which got a lot of attention for the song. And that led me to writing two more songs for that production. So I ended up writing three original songs.
Excellent.
And that was just a joyful thing. And began a long friendship and partnership with Kristen.
Nice, nice. So were you more compelled to write in the style of that show, not rather than your original sounds? You had to kind of make sure everything blended together.
Yeah, I did. I had to look at the original material, which I loved a great deal, and figure out how I would write new things that had a nod in that direction that felt like they were from the same score. They also have my particular voice in them somewhere embedded into those songs, but I also had to adapt what I do in order to be able to make it sound like it came from the same show. And that was a particular creative challenge that I think we rose to.
So down at TheaterWorks, The Life of the Party, or a view of some of your great tunes performed with friends. Tell us about the show.
Well, The Life of the Party premiered at the very famous theater in London called the Menier Chocolate Factory in 2014. They are such a fantastic organization run by a guy named David Babani, who is our director. And David is my friend and came to me and said, what about doing an Andrew Lippa night? What about doing a show? And one of the things we hit on early was we wanted to not just do a show where I came out and told people about my songs and sang some songs, but that we actually did segments of my shows. So we do these little mini Reader's Digest versions of the show. We'll do four or five songs from Big Fish or The Addams Family or The Wild Party, along with three other incredible cast members in the show and a small orchestra. And so it makes the audience feel like they're actually seeing a version of the show. And then it's dotted with a few single songs and some narrative from me talking about various things that have inspired me through the years.
The challenge must be, of course, with the increasing body of work that you've accumulated, what ends up on the floor versus what comes onto the stage.
Yeah, that was the fun challenge of figuring out what not to include. And some of that was driven by the notion of what kind of actors we were going to have and how we were going to present the material. So I think we found a really good balance of old and new. And there are a couple things from The Man in the Ceiling, as you mentioned, which is yet to happen. Next year is our world premiere production at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor. And so it's fun to include stuff the audience wouldn't know. And then, of course, there's a lot of material in the show that's already been done on Broadway and or tours around the country.
In addition to what's happening at Sag Harbor, what else is in your library that's coming up?
Well, next year is the UK premiere, 26-week tour of The Addams Family that is expected to land in London at the end of the year. And so I'm going to be over there working on that, putting that production together. Then The Man in the Ceiling, which I'm also in, and then the UK premiere also of Big Fish, which is going to happen in London, and a little bit of a, going back to my Jerome Robbins quote, a bit of a reworking of that show, and there's a couple new songs in it, and it's quite a bit of new writing. So I'm excited about those three new productions next year.
Nice. The Life of the Party runs at TheatreWorks Silicon Valley today, opening night. Thanks for coming in on your opening day. Gosh, you got to get down there and get a little relaxation time or warm up before the show tonight. It runs through the 18th, information at theaterworks.org. The San Francisco Chronicle's Lily Janiak said Andrew Lippa's songbook is at once mischievous and full of pathos, boyishly wholesome and downright dirty. Well, it should be an interesting show. Let's go out with the title song, The Life of the Party. Self-explanatory, or do you want to give us a little setup on that?
It's the beginning of Act Two of The Wild Party. It's the character of Kate, who's the mischievous character, and she's the downright dirty character in that show as well. So I think the rest will explain itself.
Well, I hope it's airable for radio. We haven't screened it yet.
It is.
All right, Andrew, thanks for coming in, and have a great run.
Thanks for having me.
Who needs it? Not me. Who needs fortune or fame? I don't need a new career, a sympathetic ear, a name. All I need is time to play. Only want the game. Point me to the mic. I know what I like. Don't you wanna be the life of the party? Don't you wanna be the cream of the crop? Don't you wanna feel those shivering fits till someone calls it quits or someone calls a cop? Don't you wanna land the role of a lifetime? Well, you better get down on one knee, 'cause you could play the life of the party if you can pray with me. Above. Don't have time for things unsaid, for baking bread, for love. All I need is room to fight, hand in fist and glove. Point me to the sky, it's my turn to fly. Don't you wanna be the life of the party? Don't you wanna be the top of the heap? The wine, let the drinks pour, let the crowds roar, let the heavens wildly cheer till the sunrise brings the goodbyes. I'll be here, never fear. Oh, who's it gonna be?
Life of the Party, Words and Music by Andrew Lippa. The same named show, The Life of the Party, a review of some of Andrew's great tunes performed with friends, is at Theater Works, Silicon Valley through the 18th. Opening night tonight. Information at theaterworks.org. Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulipe, your host for our weekly performing arts magazine of the air, Open Air. Still to come, you'll hear about the opening gala production of Andrea Chenier at the San Francisco Opera, which is next Friday, a full weekend of amazing operatic events ahead for next week. And I'll have a bit of a ticket giveaway for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, which is performing this Saturday. Well, next, 15 actors and singers, along with 30 dancers, will bring the acclaimed dance theater work The Conference of the Birds, based on the ancient Sufi poem of the same name, to life in a piece originally written by Academy Award-winning screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière, first translated and directed by legendary British theater and film director Peter Brook in 1979. This sumptuous reimagining of the original is being presented by Anact and Sangam Arts. The Conference of the Birds will take 10 dance traditions spanning four continents out of their respective silos and gather them on stage with a score from Randy Armstrong, a leading exponent of the world fusion movement. It's for four performances only next Friday, September 9th at 8, Saturday the 10th at 2 and 8, and next Sunday the 11th, all at the Mexican Heritage Plaza in San Jose. And here to talk about the production are the producer and director, respectively, Usha Srinivasan and Vinita Balani. Welcome to you both to Open Air.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for having us.
Well, how do we start here? This production has an interesting history. Perhaps you can tell us about its African roots.
Oh, very deep African roots. So Peter Brook and Jean-Claude Carrière in the late 70s, they had this International Center for Theater, and they decided to trek across sub-Saharan Africa with the theater company. They had 22 actors from pretty much all over the world, and they were going to go into little villages and do theater with the villages. And one of the little books that they carried with them was a translation of this 12th century poem by Fariduddin Attar called Conference of the Birds. And it's a beautiful story because it's the philosophy of Sufism, but explained as an allegory of birds going on a journey seeking their true king. And as the birds demur and make excuses for going on the journey, the hoopoe, who's the wise old bird leading them, tells them stories to explain why they should go on the journey. So there are stories within stories within stories. And some of those stories got used to create theater experiences for villagers who had never seen theater before, who had never seen white people before, who had never seen shoes before. So it was, you know, one of the people who went on that journey was a very young Helen Mirren, who all 22 actors became very famous in their respective countries as actors. So obviously it was a transformative experience for all of them. It was also a transformative experience for Peter Brook and Jean-Claude Carrière. And when they came back from that journey, they decided to write it as a play. And that was the first time, they did this several times after, but that was the very first time that they actually took an epic from a culture that was an ancient culture that they didn't come from, and transpose it into a universal story that could be understood by everybody, and strip it sort of its cultural moorings and release it into the universe.
That's Vinita Balani, founder and artistic director of Enact Arts, as well as the director of the Conference of Birds. Vinita, tell me about the founding of Enact Arts.
Oh, that's another Jean-Claude Carrière story.
Okay.
As a lot of stories seem to be. He's a prolific storyteller for six decades. So I was living in Paris. I'm a computer scientist. I was working for a tech company. And I was having dinner one night, and I found myself sitting next to this person called Jean-Claude Carrière, who had been my absolute idol because he had written the play, The Mahabharata, which is the 9.5-hour epic that Peter Brook had directed, which it was a seminal moment in theatrical history. And I just couldn't believe I was sitting next to him. And he was very approachable. And I mentioned to him that I had kids who were now as old as I was when the Mahabharata had first come out. And it was possibly time to do another 9.5 version of the Mahabharata under perhaps, you know, different interpretation. And he looked at me and he said, do you have a theater company? And I said, no, but I can form one. And I did.
Good for you.
So the first thing that the theater company, fledgling theater company, did was we toured a 90-minute storytelling one-man piece by Jean-Claude Carrière across cities, to six cities across America that following year. And this is a storytelling that he had developed in little villages in France and Spain, and he would tell the story in French and in Spanish to villagers, you know, under a tree in the open air on a hillock, exactly the way it had been told 5 millennia ago, wow. 4 millennia ago in India by the wandering minstrels who actually constructed what is the Mahabharata today.
Wow.
So that's how it all began.
Nice. Usha Srinivasan, you started Sangam Arts after some 18 years working also in the high-tech environment. Tell us about Sangam Arts.
Yes. So Sangam Arts is an organization whose mission is to help promote multicultural understanding through the arts. You know, I was predominantly focused on my career in tech right until, you know, 2012. But then my daughter and I took up a classical Indian dance form called Bharatanatyam. And what we noticed was that most of these culturally rooted dance traditions or music, for example, are, while they're performed at a very high caliber here in the Bay Area, they're largely consumed and appreciated within their own communities and silos. And it got me thinking about why that was, and thinking about what the ideal would be. And the ideal would be that we, each of us, bring our traditions, our dance traditions, our music traditions, and figure out a way that we can integrate with others without losing what it is that is unique to us. And so the way I was thinking about it would be such a shame if you go to Venice and just stay in your hotel room, which is really what we're doing when we only focus on our own communities. Mm. And this is happening not just in the Indian community, but, you know, pretty much every other community that you can think of. We have a very nuanced, differentiated view of our own culture, but a very homogenous kind of often stereotypical view of other cultures. And so this was my way of trying to change that. And with the Silicon Valley in particular getting more diverse, you know, right now there's no single race or ethnic group that makes up more than a third of our population. And that's a very dramatic shift over a period of 20 years. And this trend towards diversity is only going to intensify. So I felt like there was a need for us to come up with an alternate model of social integration, and what better way to do it than through the arts, because it's non-threatening, it's not driven by any agenda.
That's fantastic. That's Usha Srinivasan. She is the producer of the Conference of the Birds taking place next weekend at the Mexican
Actually,
Heritage.
Actually, we are co-producers.
Co-producers, mm-hmm. All right.
Yes.
But Vinita, you have the directing credit all to yourself, is that correct?
Well, I share it with Antra Bhardwaj, who's our music and dance director, and with Pratiksha Shah, who's our assistant director. But the vision is mine, yes.
Okay. Well, now, I have to personally admit ignorance about the Conference of the Birds, sometimes called Speech of the Birds, mm-hmm. considered one of the most celebrated examples of Persian poetry. I'm wondering if you could tell us how each of you first encountered the poetry yourselves.
So,
this is Usha?
Yeah. Vinita is the one that actually was quite intimately familiar with the play itself, thanks to her association with the playwright, Jean-Claude Carrière. But how we met was really interesting. I was on the board of the Ethnic Dance Festival and presented in 2014 about 8 different Indian dance forms in a single presentation. And so as a result, you know, Vinita heard about the production through Sangam Arts. And, you know, and I'll let Vinita take it from there.
So to go back to Jean-Claude Carrière, as all conversations do today, he and I, while taking the Mahabharata around to 6 cities in the U.S., talked a lot. And obviously his Conference of the Birds experience in Africa and the subsequent writing of the play figured largely in those conversations. And I obviously read the play. I read the poem, which is much longer. It's 45,000 stanzas
wow.
long. Mm-hmm. And it was just incredibly beautiful. Peter Brook is a minimalist director. And when I read the play, I did not I mean, I saw how Peter would do it minimal, in a very minimalist manner, but for me, this was a celebration of humanity. You know, the play opens with the lines, all the birds of the world, those we know and those we don't, gathered together for a great conference. And I had lived and worked in 9 countries across 4 continents by then, and I could see the birds from all the various countries and continents all gathered together. And for me, there was a fluidity in the poem that lent itself to dance. But what I had in front of me was a theater piece. And so fundamentally, I wanted to do this as a theater piece, but I needed the dance. And I had gone to see a show at the World Arts West mm-hmm. Festival, and I approached the board and I said, I'd like to do a play in which all of them dance together, and they introduced me to Usha, and mm-hmm. that was, yeah. as and we say,
the rest is history. Yeah, and this is a perfect platform or vehicle, if you will, for showcasing the kind of multicultural arts that Sangam Arts does, in the sense that we bring together these different people that have their very unique traditions. We're not fusing them together, we're not creating new forms, but at the same time, the end result is something that's beautifully unique and American.
Well, tell us a little bit about the different dance styles that will be represented.
Mm-hmm. So I'll start alphabetically. We have Azteca dance, your magnificent dancers from San Jose. We have Afro-Brazilian ballet, Bharatanatyam, which is an Indian classical dance form. 2 forms of Chinese folk dance. We have hula, folklorico, Persian dance, belly dance, Odissi and Kathak. So, and you will see Randy Armstrong's created music for these different dancers in the play that is very true to their traditions. He's used 70 different instruments. So it's just magnificent score, and the dancers are working with their choreographers to produce something that's authentic, but at the same time quite seamlessly integrated within the play.
We'll actually hear some of Randy Armstrong's music next. He's a leading exponent of the World Fusion Movement, and his music will be featured in this performance of the Conference of the Birds next weekend, the 9th at 8 p.m., the 10th at 2 and 8, and September 11th at 4 p.m. It's all at the Mexican Heritage Plaza in San Jose. Where do we go for information on that one?
You can go to tinyurl.com/DCOB, or you could go to either of our websites. So tinyurl.com/DCOB for Conference of the Birds.
And I understand there's dancers who will be ranging in age from 5 to 85.
Yes.
Amazing.
And the actors.
Usha Srinivasan and Vinita Balani, thank you for coming in, and I wish you wonderful performances.
Thank you for having us.
Information about the Conference of the Birds at enact.org. That's enacte.org.
Thank you.
That's just a taste of the beautiful voice of my next guest, Janae Bridges, singing O Malheur Immortel from Charles Gounod's Sappho, a not often performed opera. Hopefully we'll come back into the repertoire a little bit. She'll be making her San Francisco opera debut in the role of the maid Bercy in the opening gala production of Umberto Giordano's French Revolution set opera Andrea Chenier. It's a jam-packed weekend ahead next weekend with the gala opening next Friday, September 9th, a Saturday spectacular premiere production of Bright Shang's Dream of the Red Chamber, and free opera for all in the popular Opera in the Park in Golden Gate Park on Sunday the 11th. For the gala opening and run of Andrea Chenier, Young-Hoon Lee will be making his company debut in the title role, as will Anna Pirozzi in the role of Maddalena. And as I mentioned, my next guest, Janae Bridges. Mezzo-soprano Janae Bridges recently completed a 3-year residency with the distinguished Ryan Opera Center at Lyric Opera of Chicago. At the Lyric, she sang the role of Carmen in the world premiere of Bel Canto, an opera by Jimmy Lopez, based on the novel by Ann Patchett. That was last season. A couple of other recent highlights include performances of Ravel's Chanson Medicas with Yo-Yo Ma and members of the Chicago Symphony, the title role of the Bizet Carmen with Finger Lakes Opera, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 with the Santa Fe Symphony. Janae, welcome to Open Air and our airwaves.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm also pleased to welcome for the first time to KLW's airwaves my own resident opera expert, Ron Seeley, whose encyclopedic knowledge of opera continues to astound me. He's also been my soulmate for the past 29 years. Welcome to you, Ron.
Thank you, David.
Happy to share your expertise on opera. And why don't you talk a little bit about Andrea Chenier? And
well, Andrea Chenier is the best-known opera by Giordano. A few of his other operas were performed a lot in the 19th century, but not too much these days. Andrea Chenier is set in the French Revolution. It's actually based on a true story. Andrea Chenier was a poet who, although he was from sort of the aristocracy, he was associated with the aristocracy, he has some sympathies with the revolution. He wrote a very strong poems that protested against a lot of the injustice in society at the time. And so he basically was on the outs of the aristocracy, he was in London for the first 2 years of the French Revolution, and he came back to France thinking the danger was over and everything was fine. And then he just continued to write all these inflammatory speeches and poems and things and basically set everyone against him. And he ended up being executed, guillotined, in 1794, just 3 days before the death. Robespierre himself was guillotined.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
Janae, is this your first encounter with this opera?
This is my first encounter with this opera, and I'm loving it. I will be encountering it again later this season in Munich at the Bayerstadt Opera. So it's nice to first encounter it in San Francisco, where I will be debuting as well.
With a couple other people making their company debuts.
Yes,
it's fantastic.
Basically the whole cast.
your main aria that you have a kind of encounter with one of characters that's called the Incroyable,
yes,
which are also combined with La Merveilleuse. Ron or Janae, can you tell us about those two elements of the French Revolution?
Well, as a sort of a reaction, after the initial excesses of the French Revolution, some of the aristocracy took on this very sort of cynical, dark, comic persona and the men called themselves the Incredibles, les Incroyables, and they would dress in these like fantastic dandyish costumes and walk around and have these like wild parties and things. It was all very decadent, and then the female version of that was a merveilleuse, a marvelous, a fabulous like woman, and they would just dress up these dandies and have these like, crazy parties, and it was all very just very corrupt and decadent, and it was just it was a symptom of the just sort of anemia of the society, just the society without any, they completely lost all anchor to sort of morality or tradition or societal norms. And it was just kind of the aristocracy gone off the deep end.
Yeah. And then to add on to that, I opened the second act actually with my aria as a merveilleuse. And it's interesting because in the first act, I play the maid. I'm very, I have this gorgeous costume, 18th century costume, and my costume in the second act, as Merveilleuse, is a little bit less dressed. I'm wearing basically kind of a beautiful sheet. My hair is a little bit more wild, and so I take on this different role. You know, during the day I'm the maid, and I'm very kind of behind the scenes, and at night I'm the life of the party.
Nice.
So it's fun. It's a fun contrast.
Well, Janae Bridges, I wish you a wonderful debut. Looking forward to the production on opening night, and
thank you.
A spectacular toy for the rest of the run.
Thank you very much,
Ron. I'm wondering if you could introduce for us one of the most famous arias from Giordano's Andrea Chenier, La Mamma Morta.
La Mamma Morta is a very famous aria from this opera for the soprano, Maddalena. And she basically just sings this heart-wrenching aria about her dying mother and, you know, what she learned from her dying mother about how, you know, love is, you know, what sends your soul into flight, basically. And it was used very memorably in the movie Philadelphia in a scene with Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington.
Well, Ron, I'm sure we'll have you on again for some more opera talks. And again, thanks for coming in, Janae.
Thank you.
During this amazing aria, I wish to offer some tickets to the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony this Saturday. I have two pairs of tickets. 415-841-4134. Don Harms leads the orchestra and Saint-Saëns cello concerto with Emile Milan as soloist. Elgar C. Pictures of Jill Grove as mezzo-soprano and Brahms' Fourth Symphony. 415-841-4134. Two pairs of tickets. Call now. To do this, but we do have to go to the news with the BBC. That's the great Montserrat Caballé. If you want to hear this complete aria, and you'll want to hear this complete aria, as well as the full production of Andrea Chenier, go to sfopera.com for more information. The opening production is next Friday evening and a gala production, and it runs for a good part of the month. sfopera.com. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air, our weekly magazine of the performing arts, here on 75-year-old today, KALW Local Public Radio here in San Francisco.